You will sleep better than you have ever slept. You've never been this relaxed. Are you ready to change your life?
I'm Rusty Diamond, certified hypnotist. You don't need to leave your house. You can stay in your bed. You can stay in your favorite chair. You just need a computer or your phone. You can get a hold of me. Stay at home. I'll make your life better.
HypnosisIsGreat.com.
It's Rusty Diamond, motherfucker. It's Rusty Diamond, motherfucker.
Yo, and boom, it's Rusty. What's up, everyone? Welcome to a special Saturday show. Motherfucking Saturday. I'm here because I get to do a Saturday every once in a while, and every day should be every day, and every day is whatever. Every day is cool. It's not cool. You can change it. That easy. It sounds easy. Might not be easy, but it's easy. All you have to do is just change your mind a little bit. So thank you, everyone, for being here on the Public Access Podcast, the podcast now out of Pennsylvania, the podcast. So if you are listening here and you want to know, what does this guy look like? You can go onto YouTube or Rumble. The show's on there, easy to find. And if you are watching this on YouTube or Rumble and you're like, oh, fuck, I don't like looking at this guy, but I know he has cool content and awesome guests, then you can just go to anywhere where you listen to podcasts, except for your one there, Mr. Hipster. I don't know if I'm not on that one or not. I might be. So thank you, everyone, for being here. And it's time for me to bring on my special guest. And my special guest is right here and right now. And my special guest right here and right now is N. Zondi. Welcome, welcome. Thank you for being here.
That song is in my head now. It's Rusty Diamond, my motherfucker. It's Rusty Diamond, my motherfucker. It's Rusty. Diamond, motherfucker. I love it. That's hot.
Thank you. Oh, man, I appreciate that. I'm going to have that be the new remix to the song. Have you do it in here. That's a hell of a lot better than me trying to talk and whatever you would call that. Thank you. Yeah, I like getting to, you know, have my own stuff. There's two, you know, everything's kind of DIY, and I like to collaborate when I can. What about you? What's your collaboration style? Where are you, or are you as much of do it yourself, or where are you with collaboration?
Both. I'd rather do it myself, you know, because it's just so hard depending on others, their time schedules, their, you know, their passion into it sometimes is not the same as mine. But bottom line is, I couldn't have done anything without collaboration. Somehow or another, you know, it took a team for me to do anything that I needed to do, you know. So,
like what's been some collaborations you've had going, or had people kind of helping you out along the way? Are you helping them out along the way, or working together?
You know, mostly I'm a writer. That's what I do with most of my time. And even with that, I needed, you know, I wouldn't have been able to write anything without mentors to help me out, without a publisher to put the stuff out, you know. But I did a track called Teenage Rockstar, and it was cool on its own. You know, it's a rock track, alternative track. But I had to collaborate with Dave Moreno, who's been with a lot of cool bands, and he's been touring for the last few years playing drums. He plays drums for Puddle of Mud. He had to come on. And once he put his drum on it, man, he's like one of the hottest drummers in LA. So once David put his, you know, put his touch to it, that was a collabo. And then, you know, I don't know if you heard of the song Slam, doo, 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 let boys be boys.
Onyx. So,
Onyx, man. Fredro came and dropped it and laced. And him, me and Fredro used to, Fredro and I used to watch, what's that horror flick? Blood, on Cinemax. Blood, I can't even think of the name. True Blood.
Okay.
Those episodes together, and so he knew I was like all into the vampire monster world with my writing, and he came on the track Teenage Rockstar and laced it with this really sick vampire kill them all kind of vibe, and so that was a really cool collabo, you know. And it wouldn't have been the way it is now had it not been like, you know, me collaborating with other cats. So
and so then, were you making music then before you were writing? And was that just then you decided this is an easy crossover, or is it, was it, you know, someone, what would someone said to you, hey, you should get into making these books from it? Or was it you just sort of dipping your toe in it with my lyrics or sounding like this? This would be good as a story.
I came out of my mother's womb singing Rusty Diamond. I came out of my womb, out of mom's womb singing, you know. I've been doing music for a long time, man. And, I did a couple of cool things way back. Like I did a track with Nice and Smooth, a group called Nice and Smooth. And, you know, Greg Nice put me in the studios on in New York in D&D Studios and had me play all the keys for a track they were producing for New York. Called Dirty Dog, you know. So I did some that, and this really hot group called Inner City. Back in the days, they, you know, the guy who started the group, Kevin Saunderson, you know, he was one of the three members who started Detroit Techno Music or Techno Music, and me with tracks. And so I did produced a really cool track called Share My Life that came out, charted and on Billboard for a little bit back in the days. And so music was always a part of me, but music is kind of like that girlfriend. You ever had a girlfriend that you broke up with and you see her later, years later, you're like getting some coffee and you see her and you go, wow, oh my, hey. And you step up to, hey, you look great. She's like, you look great too. We should have coffee or dinner sometimes. And then you go out with her again and you realize why you broke up in the first time. That's music for me. It's like a love-hate relationship with music. Like, it's a part of me. I dream it, you know, but the writing is really what I was put on this earth for, writing horror stories, writing short stories, mostly novels. And so it took a long time, you know, it took a path, a journey, as most of us, you know, we go through a journey. And I realized that writing horror stories was what I was put on this earth to do. So, you know, that's kind of what I, and then after I won the Bram Stoker for writing and I'd written over 1 million words and put out 4 books and over 18 short stories, you know, I said, let me get back to some music and see if I can, what I've learned over the years and my discipline is better. See if I can get back into it. And I have, and it's cool. You know, I'm on like 300 indie radio stations on the dial, FM dial, and a lot of them on the internet. So it's cool, you know, but
not what you're loving.
No, I love it. You know, I love it, you know, but you know, I got to stick to my guns, man. Sometimes as creators, we like to do a lot of different things. So I got to always remember to stick as fun and as exciting as that going out with that ex-girlfriend is, you know, I got to go back home and stay with what's home, my home base, and you know, keep focused on that, which is writing hard.
Have to remember why there's an X in front of it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then so with your stories, then were you, I don't know, were they like, just coming out one after another, and were they was it just like you sitting down? I like this question too. Did you have like a small notebook like this, or did you have like a yellow legal yellow pad, or did you have a typewriter, or did you have a computer, or your phone, or a stone and chisel, or any of
Yes,
those?
yes. Even have tissue from Hooters when I was in Hooters one day, writing, on a Hooters napkin. I have all of those. I have tons of notebooks. I even, I have all of those. I put notes on my phone, and all of that stuff, contributes to my writing. I have stories that have been brewing in my mind for years, that aren't quite ready to come out yet. And I have stories that, I'm working on now that I try to stay focused and get that done one at a time and move on. So yes, to all those questions.
Do you keep all your notes then, or do they eventually find a time to make it to the dumpster, or is it or are they hanging around for some future thing where you can put them all together and make a collage type of a book that are just all your notes and first drafts of stories and
I
stuff of that nature?
keep all of my notes, and even when I clean up my novels, my drafts, and do, rewrites, I keep all of the old stuff that I got rid of. I have files, like one of my files is over 100,000 words of outtakes, stuff that I took out. And
Wow.
so if I go back and reference it, because it's some good stuff, it just, I couldn't use it at that time, and then I reinsert it. So I keep it all, man.
So where do those end up? Is that like on each individual piece of paper written out or typed out, and then you just go and thumb through it and try to find your what that is somewhere and be like, oh, here it is. Let's put this in the story.
I have a system now. So I have I've had so many of those situations where I have them all over the place and can't find it. So now I put them in a file called outtakes, and I separate each outtake. I separate it with a line, and then above that outtake, I'll put what that topic is. This is story in the bedroom, fight between these two kids, whatever it is, and so it helps me find it when I want to go back and reference it.
And so then where kind of your story is coming from? Where was it with wanting to do horror? Was that something that just you were into earlier and then you're just like I could do this? Or was it adding something that you experienced, or maybe knew someone that experienced it?
Man, I have lived it, most of it has come from this really weird, strange, just crazy imagination that I have. But a lot of that imagination was built on just so many terrors that I've experienced in my life, either physically myself, or externally through stories and news stories and people that I've met, their stories. And I'm like, wow, that'd make a great, and I just flip it and twist it. So combination of things, real life experiences with just the crazy imagination, and also exposure to just reading so many incredible, brilliant stories from, some of the greatest, writers of our time. So a combination of all those things have helped me. Have put the seeds of horror in my heart.
And then, so then, with your books, are they do you ever do like an audio version of them too? Or do you are they meant to be read without any sort of audio, expectations, I guess, and kind of get you thinking the way that you can by twisting the way you say your words to make someone feel a different way than how they may read it on paper?
Yeah, that's a good question, Rusty. Yeah, man, as they say in Jamaica, soon come. It's soon coming, man. Yeah, it's all a process. So my first book was published by Montauk Press. And at the time when they published it, they didn't really have a system of doing audiobooks. That was 2013.
Did you
And
say Montauk?
Montauk Press. Do
Like
you know
the island?
like I think more like Ray Bradbury. Montauk.
Okay. All
Yeah.
right.
Because
Gotcha.
all books will be burned. That's like their little logo.
Cool.
burn all the books or something like that. And and then I published three books with Omni and Gatherer Media, and at the time they weren't ready to do audiobooks.
Oh, okay.
And the book, it's a really good book. You guys should get it. You should read it, called Owari Mosaic, which is like a post-apocalyptic, you know, really cool science fiction mystery. It's a combination of all those elements, YA book. That's the one that won the Bram Stoker. Omni and Gatherer published that book, and then Crossroad Press reprinted it once Omni and Gatherer folded. And so Crossroad Press is going to make it an audiobook. So I'm looking forward to that, you know.
Are you doing it?
No, I'm not doing it. A lot of people have heard me do some readings, and they said, you should do your own readings. No, you know, let's hire some professionals, you know, and have them, you know, do the audio. There are quite a few good ones. I don't know their names per se, but a lot of my colleagues and peers have suggested some of the really popular ones that should do the reading. So I'll leave that up to my publisher, you know, whenever they're ready to. Yeah.
And like I was saying, like, you might give it some different, you know, ways that you're saying some words that people are going to go and take something a different way than someone. They're just picking up a book and reading what they're, you know, coming up with, would be different than probably what you would do by reading it. I don't know. Let's see. Where are you with, cause this is something that comes up now, with the AI and that, kind of deal, because I mean, just about anything that I do now, I am, you know, seeing that AI is doing, you know, kind of, you know, you get the music, the art, the writing, the podcasting, you know, kind of everything. Where are you with it? Where do you stand?
I stand. So I am a believer of there are three, the power of three. So in the power of three, you have the positive, your left hand, you have or your right hand, you have the negative, your left hand, and then you have the center, the neutral. And with anything, I believe, you know, human nature, we put negativity as in being something bad, but really negativity in my life means, or in my understanding and in my belief system, means something that, you know, that receives, something that takes, you know, what do I need? What are the tools that I need? Okay. What are the tools that I need? Right. And, you know, the positive is, you know, how can I expand? How can I expand on this creativity? Or what can I make? And then the neutral is, you know, what action do I need? What's in my heart? Right. So AI, I think, is the same thing. You know, AI to me is, you know, something that I can use. What do I need? Right. And then I add it to, you know, what can I create? And then with my art, you know, in my mind and in my heart, you know, with my love. So those three things help me to manifest. And manifest means, you know, mani, you know, the I think the Latin origin of mani means hands, right? And fest comes from party. Creating a party with my hands, manifest. So what can I manifest with my hands? You know, so AI, I mean, I've used AI in music. It's some really great tools out there to help you kind of really understand your mix with AI. I've mastered with AI, you know, and in the film, you know, a lot of my colleagues in the film industry, I work in the film entertainment industry, are very scared of the AI. It's going to replace us. I think that, you know, we're at a stage now where AI can be very, very useful in manifesting even more incredible, fabulous, next level art and artistry. So I don't believe that someone should have AI write their entire novel. There's like a lady going out and she's teaching courses on how to write your novels through AI. Yeah, I don't believe that. You know, I think that's almost like cheating in a way. You know, you got to write your own novel. But you can write your own novel and use AI to clean it up or, you know, whatever, give you best, you know, I use Grammarly now, you know, Grammarly is on all my stuff. And so it'll tell me underline something misspelled. You know, I miss that all the time. My first book, you know, even when it was published, it was like a lot of stuff I missed that my editor missed, and AI can help you clean that up. That's great. So I'm neutral on that. I think it's something that we can use, take, and something we can add on and manifest some really great creative works. Very long-winded. Yeah.
That's what I like. That's what the show's about. So with your first book, when you got to the part of I'm going to make a book, did you start making it, or did you go to a publisher or editor and try to pitch it, or did you start writing it, finish it, and then pitch it around to try to get an editor, or how'd that work out?
Man, I was lucky. So I came from a background of teaching. I've been in education for over a decade, around 12 to 13 years. And I started off at the very, very bottom as a substitute teacher, then a permanent sub, then a teacher's assistant, and then I became a certified teacher. And that background in education really taught me that if I really wanted to master something, I needed some organized instruction, you know, some workshops, some classes. And so when I quit teaching to learn how to write, you know, I started volunteering with a writers group with the Greater Los Angeles Writers Society. And through that, I volunteered, met tons of people. I volunteered at all the different conferences we did, all the different meetings we did. Through all of that volunteering that I did, I became vice president, met a lot of people. So it was a process. And during all that time, I was studying the art of writing, studying the art of having great narratives. And then I was doing a lot of reading, a ton of reading. And it was all a process. My first book was terrible. It was like, it had everything in it. It was the worst book ever. You know, it had like spies in it. It had natural disasters, vampires, you know, monsters. It had everything in it. And it was horrid, you know, had everything but a great plot. And so once I got through that and I started writing my first book, The Confessions of Silver Slasher, you know, I kind of had some groundwork and some rules, and I understood a little bit more about writing. And so I wrote the whole entire book, and then I started the whole process of submitting. How do I know that writing is what I was put on this earth to do? I believe, you know, it's just my belief system. I believe when you have a magic in something, like it's magical. There are a lot of people that are incredibly talented but never go anywhere. And I believe that's sometimes because they don't have that magic in it. And magic is a combination of a lot of stuff. So I believe when you have that magic in something, people respond to it pretty quickly. And a professional will want to give you money or support you or sponsor you, right? You don't have to pay for anything when you have the magic, you know? And so when I submitted my first novel, the Confessions of Silver Slasher, I had to go to work. So I submitted it. Went to work, and I checked, and I got an email back, and I looked at the timestamp 15 minutes after I submitted it. That's magic. And Whoa. And it was send in your entire manuscript. You know, when you submit, sometimes you just submit 10 pages, 50, whatever it was. I can't remember at that time. It was 2010 or something when I submitted it. And yeah. I submitted the entire manuscript, and 3 days later, I got a reply back. We love this book. This is the fastest we've ever replied. We want, and they sent me a contract in 3 days of submitting the manuscript. That's magic. And so that's what happened. You know, it took a long time for me to really understand how to write a book, and a lot of studying and a lot of talking with people and a lot of sitting in workshops and a lot of going to conferences and sitting in panels before I understood what needed to be there, and a lot of reading before I really understood, you know, what needed to be there. And then I submitted it. And then once I submitted it, and it got accepted, then it went through that whole process of their editor, you know. And I also went to an editor before I submitted it. I had my own editor because I was in a critique group, and one of the people in the critique group edited stuff. So it went through two edits through that guy, and I cleaned it up before I submitted it to the publisher. So it was a whole process, man.
How long was that process for your first book? From the time that you sent in the 15 minutes, like when you sent in the first little bit of it to when it's sent out as something that's available to the public.
18 months. It took 18 months. Yeah.
Shit. Did you ever have any times where you got it back and you're like thinking I'm all done, and then they go, oh, hey, here's a little bit more we need you to do?
Yes. Listen. So when I first wrote the book, and this is, you know, every publisher is a little different, but when I first wrote the book, I had sex scenes in it. I had drugs and alcohol in it. And the editor said, you know, we think this could be really good in the young adult market, in the YA market. What do you think? I'm like, hell, I ain't, whatever you guys want to do, I will cooperate. You know, I just, you know, you get it out there, I'm happy. I'm cooperating and I'm compliant. And she said, okay, good. This is what you need to do. There are, I think she said three or four. I can't remember now. She said there are four things. Yeah, four things that are taboo in our company. She said, and you can only keep, I think she said you can only keep one of them or two of them. She said drugs and alcohol. No, not with YA, or profanity. No. Violence. No. And sex. Yeah, it was four things. And sex. She said you can pick one. You can keep one. You know, so I got rid of the drugs and alcohol. As much as I tried to make it really nice, I had to get rid of the sex and I had to get rid of the profanity. So I kept the violence, you know, it was, you know, martial arts, you know, slashing zombies. So I kept the violence. So that was one out of four that I had to keep. And then I had a deadline. I stayed up for 18 hours and rewrote everything and went through and cleaned the whole thing up. Got rid of the curse words, got rid of the drugs and violence, got rid of all of that stuff. I tried to keep the sex in it, but that went through two or three passes and we finally just got rid of the sex. And then I also had to change it. I think she was older. It was like 19 or 21 or something like that. She said, you know, the editor said that I had to have her stay under 18. She said, you know, with YA, the characters, it would be anywhere from preteen to 18, but not necessarily the main character, but not necessarily older. So I had to go through and change every single reference to her being older than 18. You know, that thing took 18 straight hours. I worked 18 straight hours, cleaned it up, and then turned it in. So it was a huge process.
And so you had 18 hours to do that, and then you just did it.
And
You're
then I
just like,
slept
okay.
hours. Yeah.
And so then what did they say? Were there still things on there that you were trying to, because if it were me, I'd be trying to still sneak some stuff by and still like be like, oh, that's not really that, you know, that you're just maybe looking into it wrong or something. Or was there still things that had to get edited out that you thought you got, or did you get pretty much everything, or what?
Okay, that's a two-part question. Yeah, there were times when at that time I was a novice as far as a published author. And so understanding through education for so many years that some people, and have a lot of friends, that some people who are so like, it's got to be this way or no way. And then they got no way and they never got published or they never, their songs never came out. I'm like, I'm not going to be that guy. I'm going to be very like, I'll work with you know, very cooperative. So I approached it that way. So pretty much whatever they wanted, I did. And it came out for the better of it. You know, I was like, well, you know what? This is a professional editor. She's edited many books in this genre. You know, I gotta trust her. And I did, and it came out better than anything I would have done. I'm a little different now, also because I understand a little bit more of the rules and I'm a lot better and a lot more professional. So now if I have an idea that I really believe in, I go, no. This is why this is. And like two alphas, you know, standing together, you know, you state your positions and then either one gives or they don't give. So sometimes I'll do that and they go, nah, we're not keeping it still. And I'm like, all right, cool. You know, or sometimes they understand that, no, this can't be changed. This is the reason. Like if I have a reason behind it, a logical reason, this is the reason why this is happening because her background, you know, had led her to be this. And this is what this character, this is something this character would do. And it makes sense, then they go with it.
Yeah. And so would you ever go and take that first story and make it the way you originally wanted to make it? Or would that be something that would, you know, because I don't know, like I think about that with a lot of stories. If you know, there was someone that wrote a story that was, very adult oriented, and they're like, okay, but let's make this young adult oriented. But then the kids get older and they become adults themselves, and they're like, wait, what was this adult oriented story he did? I want to read that. Is that something you would ever revisit, or is that a kind of a closed chapter there?
I have the answer for you. Can we do a little call and response? If I
Sure.
say something, you repeat it. You ready?
Yeah.
I'm going to say something, you repeat it until we're finished. You ready?
Yes.
T.
I what'd you say?
T.
T.
R.
R.
A.
A.
S.
S.
H.
H.
Trash. It was trash. I went back. I really tried to do it. I went back and I said, I'm now going to go back to this first novel and I'm going to clean it up and make it everything that I wanted to make it. And I went back and I'm like, oh my God, I can't even clean this up. It's trash. It belongs in the garbage. And so, yeah, I tried to. I really did. But it was such trash. I'd learned so much by that time and developed so much by that time that it just wouldn't work. The concept didn't work.
Yeah. So then, okay. You ever, or what do you feel about writer's block? And do you feel it's a thing, or do you feel like you've ever gotten it? Or if you did, was there anything you did to get over it?
I have never had writer's block, but it's not to say that I don't believe people get it. I know that people get it and I understand it. I think the reason why I've never had writer's block is because, I'm kind of like a busybody. So I always have to be doing something. So when I'm writing and the story doesn't come to me, doesn't unfold, right?
Yeah.
I immediately start doing something else. I either start reading some of my favorite books, which I read all the time anyway. And when I'm reading it like a teacher grading, I was an English teacher, a teacher grading a student's paper. I underline parts that are really, really cool to me, no matter what it is. And that process is teaching me, for example, how to have a better narrative. It's teaching me, oh, you know what? I could use this kind of narrative in my book. Or I can restructure this paragraph to have this type of better narrative. It's showing me great characterization. Wow, I didn't characterize my character like this. What if I flip it like this? But it gives more depth to my character. Action scenes, description of, the room, the environment, the buildings, and that whole process. When I go back, I'm ready to write. Sometimes I say, you know what? I just kind of vaguely mentioned that they were flying a helicopter, but I didn't really explain how they're flying it or what type of helicopter it was, how the pilot, So I go back and I do research on something that I was really vague on. I didn't know a lot about. And that process of doing research may take, sometimes it takes forever because you get so excited about learning something. And then I may take one or two sentences from all that research and go back in. So basically, when the story isn't coming to me, I go
Yep.
back in passes. I'll go back in my book and do a pass. I'll do a character pass. I'll do a dialogue pass to make sure all the characters don't sound the same. I'll go back and do a plot pass. I'll go back and do a string pass where I string the chapters together where they kind of tie in a little bit better and make more sense. Sometimes I go back and do a cliffhanger pass where I make sure all the chapters are after a few chapters, it ends in a cliffhanger. So by the time I do all of that, I'm ready to write again, And so
Yeah.
I don't really have writer's block per se. I've never really had that where I'm like, I can't write for days. That doesn't happen. I always have something else I can do that, helps me to keep the plot moving.
And then, so as far as your characters go, when do you know when, let's see, or like, what's the point you can get to when you know what your character is going to do? Because of who the character is. Like I like using this example that I was taught for wrestling. When you know your character is the moment, if they go into a fast food restaurant, McDonald's or something, and the person working there fucks up their order, How does this person react? What does this person do? And then once you can kind of answer that question, then you can be able to kind of know what would happen anytime that character's in a situation, how they're going to react and what they would do. And so what's kind of your spot where you know kind of know where your character is and when they're more of a deeper dimensional character?
At first, it was very difficult to be able to discern those things. And once I started actually taking workshops and studying writing, in a formal environment, I started understanding archetypes, you know, the different types, like for example, the stereotypical football player, what does he do? The stereotypical contract, guy that works in contracting, what does he do? The stereotypical nurse, how is her behavior? The stereotypical witch, the stereotypical, whatever it is, FBI agent, stereotypical FBI agent tries out to have a lot of family, close relationships with families. They may be traveling a lot or don't want to get too close to anyone. And then once I learned the archetypes of different types of characters, then I started delving into what I've been exposed to the different characters in real life. You know, people who you meet in real life who are so bodacious or who are so quiet and mild or whatever the different characteristics are. And then I take those characteristics, that person, I never name that person. I never name, of course you don't do that, but I take that person like I have a lot of grandmotherly characters in my life, people who raised me, and they all sound the same in my head. Boy, you better not do that. I'll tan your hide. Hey boy, you getting a little bit above your britches now. And that character lives in my mind from all of those grandmotherly characters that I was exposed to. And so that goes into molding that character. And I know exactly what she would do or he would do, in response to a certain situation. And then the third more complex process of that, of understanding how to write my characters, was after you do all of that, right? I'm writing a story and I have no flipping idea what my character is gonna do. They tell me what they're gonna do. I'm actually driving sometimes to work and I'm like, oh my God, I had no idea that that character was the one who killed this character, or that character was the one that was behind this. And it just hits me, and it kind of, the story writes itself, but before I did that, I had to kind of go through these different processes to understand, the nuances of building a character and developing a character. Does
Yeah,
that
I
make sense?
mean, that makes sense. Yeah, and you had all the fundamentals laid out to be able to figure out how everything works together, and like you'd be able to have a point where you're driving and like, okay, that is why, that is who killed him, that's how they killed him, and that makes perfect sense. I mean, that would be why they would do it. And are you getting like any so are you getting people ever that are like, hey, that kind of sounds like me, or that have gone through your work, or and you're like, I don't know, but maybe it is, maybe it isn't, but is there anything ever like that, or is there anything that you think you put yourself into, like you kind of see yourself in some of the characters or anything like that?
Yeah, I don't really get, I haven't really, not yet, haven't really gotten people saying, hey, that's like me. But what I have gotten is a lot. How do you write women characters so well? I get that a lot. And I also put myself into a lot of my characters sometimes. You can't help it. You put some of your own ideals and morals and philosophies in a character. But it's very sparse. It's like all over the place. It's not like one particular, like all of my ideals into one character. It's never like that. But yeah, I do get, how do you write women characters so well? And it's because I grew up around all women, basically, and I paid attention to what they did and to their suffering and to their self-empowerment, all the different things that made them who they were. I paid attention to it, and I bring that into my characterization.
Are any of them still around?
Wow, that's a great question. No, everyone's pretty much passed away now. Yeah, no one's asked me that. That's a great question, Rusty. Yeah, no,
That's
they've
it.
all, yeah,
Oh,
passed.
thanks. Yeah. So then, I mean, that's something that would be like something that's kind of lost. Like, you know, like if it wasn't through what you had made and with your, you know, with your stories and your words and, in your books and those characters, like that, you know, that might have been something that was missed out on, you know, those people that, you know, and if they don't get to know it, you know, firsthand, I mean, they get to, you know, live on through those characters. And that's, I like that. I like that they get to have that, you know, that second go at life there. And so what about, so, okay, let's say, because when we were talking, when Mickey introduced us, Mickey also, huge thanks to Mickey, because Mickey's been great with everyone that he's brought in. He's been like, I don't know. I have some people that say, oh, I represent, you know, someone for this, you know, and I have them on your show. And, you know, 9 times out of 10, they're horrible to even work with. And Mickey's been awesome the whole time. I keep going back, and I told him that the last time someone just made me like, I don't know. I was like, I don't know how you're representing someone. Like, I wouldn't want to work with you. Like, I don't want to work with this person. So, like, I just told Mickey, thank you. And so then, so if you're working, because you said you're doing a lot of acting now, like if you're acting a whole bunch and you have a story you really want to write, is that one of the benefits of the hurry up and wait mentality of it? Or are you going, is that like a different place in your head that you don't want to be in when you're trying to act?
I'm at a crossroads now. Hey, Crossroad Press. I'm at a crossroads now where I stay on the positive. And when someone tells me or says that I act or am an actor, I have to receive that. I have to receive it. So in receiving that, thank you for calling me an actor. I have at one point in my life really, really wanted to be an actor. But when I went to college, I studied screenwriting and I studied directing, and I probably took one or two acting classes. But 98% of it had to do with writing and understanding the art, you know, of filmmaking. So that was more so what kind of was the pathway that I went into. As far as acting, I did a few things here and there, some independent stuff like that. But never really in front of the camera as, you know, guest star, et cetera, except for the one time I was a guest star on Desperate Housewives as, I forget the main character's name right now. It escapes me, but the character was played by Vanessa Williams, and it was no words, no lines.
Wait, so wait, hold on. Okay. I don't know if I should tell you this. Maybe I will. I'm a big fan of that show, and I really just finished watching it again for, I think, maybe the third time, about a month ago. And so you were in there with Vanessa Williams. What? Why am I blanking?
It was a blink. That's why you're blinking out. There was an episode. Okay. There was an episode where in season 3, episode number 16, I believe, where she was charity, what's, I can't even think of her name now. She was taking care of the baby. She was babysitting for one of the main characters, and she took her baby on a date, and they were in a restaurant. Like, who brings a baby, you know, to a restaurant? And they look and they see that it's their baby, and they go, oh my God, you brought our baby to the restaurant? And that was me on a date with her.
Okay. How fucking cool was it to be on a date with Vanessa Williams? Could you tell your younger self that one?
Bro, it was incredible because, all right, so back in the day when I was in college, we used to have the guy, like, who are your starting five, you know, in reference to basketball, who are your starting five and who's your coach? And back then, and basically, man, who would you love to date, you know? And back then, Vanessa Williams was in my starting five. I can't even remember who it was back then. It was like, I think Vanessa Williams, Raquel Welch, Megan Fox, I believe. I can't even remember who all of them were. And I think Madonna might have been my coach. I can't even remember. And so to have one of my starting five, one of my forwards, I mean, one of my point guard, to be able to beat her and be a, and yeah. play a boyfriend was the incredible, most incredible honor. And the whole time I was with her, I kept saying, don't say anything stupid. Don't say anything like you're fanboying. Be cool, be calm. And we talked a lot about, you know, because of course I was, you know, I was sitting right next to her in Video Village. Video Village is like, I mean, not Video Village, it was behind Video Village, but I was in the cast chair. I was, you know, in my cast chair, I was sitting right next to her and we talked all day about our kids, you know, and about family and just cool, really home, you know, good natured things, you know, stuff like that. And yeah. she was funny and she was brilliant and intelligent and beautiful. And I think the other characters was Chastity. I can't remember her name. And, you know, so it was a great time. I mean, it was the first time I had my own trailer and, you know, it was wonderful. It was wonderful. It was a, an amazing experience and, something I'll cherish for the rest of my life. Yeah.
What was that like having your own trailer for that first time?
Bro, I wanted to tell everybody. It was like, I was trying to, but I didn't really have anybody to tell. I wanted to do videos like, this is my trailer. I'm sitting in my trailer. I'm eating. I'm taking something out of my fridge. You know, I just wanted to show the whole world, but I really didn't post too much about it. Cause a lot of times you can't, you know, you can't like, yeah, you, know, you can't
right.
post.
You can't be like, hey, I'm in a trailer right now for this movie that, or the show that's shooting right now. And like, yeah, they, that could be frowned upon.
Yeah. Yeah. So you could, I couldn't really post a lot. So it was kind of like one of those moments where the only person who really saw me do me was me, you know? So it was right. like a very alone kind of moment, but I enjoyed it to the fullest and it was a wonderful time. But I said all of that to say that I think as far as in the entertainment world, what I do now is I'm a stand-in, which is a rehearsal actor. People don't understand what that is, but it's a rehearsal actor. We do all the rehearsals so that the cameras, the lights, the sound, everyone in the industry can kind of set up, you know, the scene, the shooting, the filming of the scene so that when the actual actor comes in, it runs smoothly. So that's what we are. We're rehearsal actors. And I'm moving towards, developing my own projects. So when I am sitting behind Video Village, I'm one of the executive producers. I'm the writer. I'm the developer of that film or that series. And that's where I'm at now. Because I have a executive producer and a production company developing a few projects in pre-development of a few projects based on my works. So I'm in that process now. So I'll, if I get cast in something, I'm going to bring my A game. I'm going to get a coaching, you know, acting coach and, you know, I'm going to do the best I can to try to, you know, to stand in the same room with those wonderful actors who have background in theater and all this and that, which I don't have any background in. I'll do that, but I don't necessarily say that I'm an actor per se, you know, but I guess maybe The Rock, you know, started out like that, you know, and The Rock is, you know, incredible and phenomenal. Has had a phenomenal career in acting. So yeah. Maybe I'll be in that kind of placeholder, you know?
Yeah. And I mean, being a stand-in is fucking, I think it's probably one of the best places. If you're not part of the crew, it's probably the best spot to be as far as figuring out how the production goes and how, cause you're there. Like where everything is, you see how everything's set up because you gotta be there to do whatever you know, block for the light or, you know, or whatever it is. And then also when you're not shooting, you're there like, usually right around the director or the you know, the whoever is back there, and you're watching them, what they're doing, and they're just like, here, you know, come check it out and come see what we're doing. And like, I felt like that's the spot where you can learn more than anything. But it's also one of the, okay, here's another question for you.
Sure.
So was it weirder was it weirder seeing the people that you are standing in for, and then all of you kind of walk out, you know, and then it's like, I'm the, you know, I'm not saying you're not good looking, but it's like I'm the not good looking version of this guy here, man. That's him, like the good looking guy on stage, or someone, or is it weirder if you're in a have you ever been in an audition with a bunch of people that look like you?
Haven't done many auditions, which is
okay.
Probably I'm not an actor. I think I may have done 4 or 5, less than 10 auditions in my entire life.
Okay.
The thing I like, there's a difference, because I work in both as a stand-in for live TV shows, like the Oscars. I just did the Oscars where I was the announcer. I came in as a stand-in, but they put me as the announcer. So I was way back in the trailer doing all the rehearsals. We did 8 days and I did 7 days of rehearsals where I'm like, and coming up next, we have the first actor, you know, and on ABC, you know, I was doing that in rehearsal. And then Whoa. David Alan Grier came in and
Dag?
Dag?
Was Dag?
I met him a long time ago, when I was standing in on Happy Endings for Damon Wayans Jr. And he was funny, man. And my cousin Deidre was one of the original Fly Girls. So told her, I said, hey, Deidre, you know, I'm working with David Alan Grier today. And she said, tell him I said hi. So when he came in and I told him that, it made our vibe really cool. You know, so he was really, really cool. He's a funny guy. He's very personable. So all that was cool. And even that first day when he came in, I kind of showed him a few things to help him. Although there was a script supervisor who was there that really, you know, showed him everything. But there were a few things that I offered. And the next day when I came in, the manager was like, stage manager was like, hey, David Alan Grier said, thank you very much for your help, blah, 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 blah. You know, so that was cool. It was really, really cool. But there's a difference in live, where I've done the award shows and stuff like that, The Voice and different things like that, and episodics. Episodics are the TV shows, the sitcoms, and the dramas. You know, where, like, for example, I was on 6 years as a stand-in, 6 years, 5 days a week on How to Get Away with Murder. And with those, when I'm standing in for those actors, you really do develop a relationship with them. Like, when I went to England, I hung out with Alfie Enoch, you know, went to one of his cricket games, eat together. You really develop a relationship. And on the episodics, you really are part of, you're the crew. You're part of the crew. So anything the crew does, you do, because you're part of the crew. On the live shows, it's like you're a cross between an extra and the crew. You're like right in the middle, you know. It's a little different. So on American Idol, on The Voice, on the award shows, the Emmys, you might have seen me on the Emmys when Christina Applegate came out. You know, I was her escort. So I was that guy on 400 or 500 different clips all over the world when they showed how powerful and, you know, how strong and self-entitled Christina Applegate was for standing up for MS. And they showed her picture. I'm the guy that's standing next to her because she wanted me right next to her on a podium. She was like, Ace, I need you right here next to me. You know, if I feel like I'm going to fall, I need to reach out and grab you. I need you. I'm like right next to you at the podium. And she was like, yes. So that was me. That was me in the tuxedo. And so those type of shows, you really are kind of like in between. But on the episodics, man, it's wonderful. So it's not really weird. You know, you don't really feel like that's the better looking guy or the great looking guy to carry.
Yeah.
You do your job. You know, you just do your job. And
yeah,
it's fun.
And so then you picked up a lot for what you're going to, you know, if you're going to have that part to kind of transfer over into, you know, being more behind the scenes to, you know, handling it yourself and knowing, you know, what goes where, what you need to make everything move smoothly.
Yeah, because working with Viola Davis was like being in a master class of how actors should act, how actors should approach, you know, their artistry, you know, and you just watch her and you're just in awe. And so a lot of things I learned just from watching her for 6 years and quite a lot of other actors that I've worked over the years. And so all of that goes into my writing. A lot of that goes into my writing and into my approach of when I do get on that stage of being an executive producer and a developer of shows. You know, it's a lot of stuff that I've learned and I will take with me. So yeah, it's an incredible experience.
Hell yeah. And so where were people going to find you? Find your work, find your books, find whatever they want to find about you.
My new website just launched 2 days ago. It's at ngondi.com. So my name.com. N is in Nancy, Z is in Zoo, O is in Osprey, N is in Nancy, D is in David, I is in Ice. ngondi.com. You go there, everything's there. My books, my music, upcoming events, a lot of the different podcasts that I've been on. Coming soon, you'll see, you know, Rusty Diamond's podcast on there. So yeah, you can go to Bonnie.com and, you know, you can get everything right there.
Cool. Well, hey, thank you so much for being on, man. I'm glad we got to have this talk. And yeah, if you want to come back maybe in like 3-4 months, something like that, that'd be cool if you're up for it.
Man, I'll be so up for it, man. If I can come in and sing that theme song again, that'll all be worth it.
Yeah, I think that's going to have to go in somewhere. That's going to have to happen now. So cool. Well, have a great rest of your day, and we'll stay in touch then.
All right. Rusty Diamond, thank you for having me, man.
You bet. All right. That's Enzondi, man. Not Enzondi, man, but Enzondi. So thank you, everyone, for being here on the Rusty Diamond Podcast Network. And that is the show. Man. Motherfucker.
It's Rusty Diamond, motherfucker. It's Rusty Diamond, motherfucker.